Beginning in the late 1960s, crime rates rose really dramatically in this country. They peaked in the 1980s and the 1990s, but they've now dropped back down to where they're not much higher than they were before the 1960s. There's considerable debate among social scientists, criminal justice professionals, and politicians about what happened and why crime rates are back to where they were to begin with. But what's undebatable is that our country still has per capita 7 to 8 times more people locked up in prison or jail than we had before the 1960s. We hold nearly 25% of the world's prisoners with less than 5% of the world's population. The social and economic costs of this incarceration are enormous, but the somewhat encouraging news, actually the encouraging news, is that politicians from the right and the left are finding some common ground for criminal justice reform, whether for prosecutorial reform, sentencing reform, prison reform. Our speaker today is a nationally recognized leader in this movement. Pat Nolan is the director of the American Conservative Union's Foundation Center for Criminal Justice Reform, located in Alexandria, and he's a leader in the National Right on Crime Project. Pat served 15 years in the California State Assembly. For 4 of those years, he was the Assembly's Republican leader. He holds bachelor's and law degrees from USC, but he has personal experience with the criminal justice system. He was prosecuted for a campaign contribution that turned out to be part of an FBI sting operation. He pled guilty and served 29 months in federal prison. He was profiled in a recent New Yorker article. As to prison itself, he was quoted as follows: "I had assumed they did all they could to help prepare the guys to return to society and make a better life, but they were just warehousing them. There was a persuasive sense of defeat. The implication is you're worthless, you come from nothing, you are nothing, and you'll never be anything." The article goes on to describe Nolan's surprise at the number of elderly and infirmed inmates, and quotes from the memoir he wrote, "Incarcerating people who aren't a physical threat to society is expensive and counterproductive, something that only a nation that is rich and vindictive would do." Now, today, Pat is going to tell us about how some states have been finding ways simultaneously to reduce prison populations, shrink recidivism, and lower costs at the same time. I think he'll also describe proposed federal and Virginia legislation with similar goals. Now, we've mentioned, I think in the last SSV meeting, that a part of SSV's mission is to not only to inform, but to do some advocacy for important projects. And I think Pat is going to tell us about some of the initiatives that are going on that I think we might like to become advocates for. And so after this, he speaks, I want you all, anybody who's interested in forming a subgroup in the Senior Statesmen of Virginia membership, to study reform efforts and to see whether we want to do some advocacy to let either me or Terry Cooper or one of the other board members know before you leave here. So having said all of these things, Pat, thanks for being here, and tell us what's going on.
I will use the stool.
We'll put this.
Yeah, I'll pull it down. Thank you. Thank you very much, Bob and Jim and John. Thank you for the flexibility on the audiovisual. I have some physical infirmities, so we're rolling with the punch here. I really appreciate this chance to discuss with you a topic that as Bob said, is getting a strong bipartisan support. It's been a long time coming. I've been involved in trying to reform the criminal justice system for over 20 years. I was blessed to be recruited by Chuck Colson, who some of you probably know from his fame in Watergate days. But when he got out of prison, he told his fellow prisoners that... told his fellow prisoners, "I won't forget you." And he founded Prison Fellowship and then also established Justice Fellowship. Prison Fellowship was to take the gospel into prison and help lift the spirits of the men and women, to give them hope. Justice Fellowship was meant to improve the system so that fewer people went into the system and more of them came out better than they went in. And he asked me to become president of Justice Fellowship. One of our challenges has been to try to engage conservative leaders in this issue. It's long been assumed to be a liberal issue, but increasingly conservative leaders have seen the flaws in the system. They see not only the cost in budgetary terms, but even more important in human terms, the lives that are destroyed, the families destroyed, the inability to find work after prison, the skills inmates learn to survive inside prison make them more dangerous when they get out. And so increasingly conservatives are joining together with liberals to call for these reforms. I'm going to show you a little video that we've put together that highlights some of the flaws of the system, because what I found is we're all proud of our system. It's a good system. We're glad that we have this system of justice, but it's also imperfect, and we shouldn't be so defensive of that system that we aren't willing to try to make it better. And this is a little reminder of some of the challenges of the system and things that we need to address as a society to make it more just, so that more young people have a chance to get back on the right path and to have a second chance in life. So, Jim, if you could roll the tape.
It's a tremendous tragedy that we have become the country that has the highest level of incarceration in the world.
America is going to arrest more than 11 million people this year. That's about 21 people a minute.
Even though we lock up a high percentage of our population, we still have a problem with crime.
Whenever I give a mandatory minimum, I'd say about 80% of the time, I think it's unjust.
Wait a minute, I'm backing you up.
Yeah.
80% of the time?
Sure.
If we don't have punishments that fit the crime, we're going to drive people into our welfare system and back into a life of crime in ways that we all would agree we don't want to happen.
You have to ask yourself, do we need to put this person, the nonviolent crime or victimless crime, there are other ways to punish them than spending $25,000 to $50,000 a year putting them in a box.
Some politician may be happy going back to their constituents and say, "Oh, I really hammered these folks," but that hammer comes at a cost to the rest of society.
And it's a reminder to us that the current system hasn't worked. It has taken mild offenders and turned them into hardened criminals, and that's the opposite of the direction we want to go in.
We have to continually, from the conservative standpoint, remind our prosecutors that we expect them to act as a filter, not just a hired gun.
One place that we don't pay much attention to is in our prisons.
She was shackled during her pregnancy, labor, delivery, and after having her baby, violating her rights.
That sounds something out of the Middle Ages, and yet in some of our prisons, that's policy.
Prisoners are human beings bearing human dignity, and sexual assault is always morally wrong.
No, you've got a part of you that's yours, and that's your body. And nobody should ever be able to violate your personal space. That's yours that nobody can ever take away from you. And he even took that away. that rape was not a part of my sentence.
There are levels of inhumane abuse that should be stopped, and that every person is a human being, whether they're a convicted criminal or not.
Back in 1992, I was arrested for the murder of a barmaid in Phoenix, Arizona, convicted solely on bite mark evidence, sent to death row, and finally in 2002, we had DNA evidence that matched another man, and I was subsequently released, and he was arrested for the murder. I spent 10 years, 3 months, and 8 days in prison for it.
Going back and either overturning a judge or a jury's decision is a very hard thing to do, but when the evidence piles up after the fact, we need to be willing to go back and reconsider those convictions in the interest of preserving liberty.
In 2014, the government took more money from people than all the burglars in the country together. This is wrong. Criminal justice reform will stop this.
I don't know why this is so hard for people who work in government. Leave our stuff alone.
The criminal justice system is a government monopoly. You know it's going to cost more than it should. You know it's going to work for the people who run it, not for the average citizen.
Conservatives want to see reform in government generally, and they definitely want to see reform when it comes to our criminal justice system.
So we have to begin to focus on watching the courts, the judges, the prisons, to make sure they serve the general good instead of just the bureaucrats involved.
You can't do this at the federal level if liberals are leading the way. Conservatives need to lead.
Well, that's sobering, isn't it? This is a system that's supposed to serve us, but is failing us in a lot of ways. Bob talked about the number of our people locked up. 2 million Americans are behind bars as we speak. In addition, 4.7 million are on probation or parole under government supervision. And that's kind of astounding to put it in terms we'll all understand. One out of every 110 Americans is behind bars, and one out of every 52 is on correctional supervision. That's an astounding rate. The greatest authority we give government, other than to kill someone, is to incarcerate them. You're stripped of everything, all control over your life. I was like an amputee, cut off from my family, from my church, from my community, from my work. And with my limbs cut off, I was tossed into this roiling cauldron of anger, bitterness, hate, sexual repression. That's not a healthy atmosphere. Yes, we need prisons. There are people that are so dangerous to us, they need to be locked up. But incarceration is not the only possible punishment for any crime. We overuse it. We send people there that have done relatively minor things. And as Newt Gingrich said, naturally, they come out more hardened. One of the things he said to me was, if you put a street-level drug dealer in with a rapist and a murderer, which do you think is going to come out more like the other? My mom used to say, vegetables take on the flavor of the stew pot. You know, we obviously, again, we need to lock up people that are dangerous, but we're also locking up a lot of folks we're just mad at. And what we found is the states are doing inventive things that still hold offenders accountable, but do it so they can remain in their community. They can remain parents to lead their families, to hold jobs, but also to be held accountable, to have drug testing, to report on their activities. So it's a balance. But we have tended over the last, since the 60s, as Bob said, to look at it, one size fits all. Somebody breaks the law, we send them to prison. No, it should be somebody breaks the law, we hold them accountable. One of the options is prison, but that shouldn't be the automatic default option. The price tag on our overuse of incarceration is astounding. $68 billion we spend on our prisons. $68 billion. And if it were making us safer, it might be worthwhile. But 40% of those that are released commit a new crime within 3 years. So something hasn't happened. You know, we haven't changed their lives. Chuck Holson, whom I mentioned I worked with, said only a nation that's rich and stupid would continue to spend billions of dollars on a system that leaves offenders unchanged, victims' needs unmet, and communities still living in fear of crime. We need to wise up. And frankly, leaders of both parties have awakened to this. In the federal system, the waste is even more than any, and it's frankly, when you get that big as a system, bureaucracies tend to become self-sustaining and self-expanding. The budget of the Federal Bureau of Prisons is now seven times what it was in 1980. It now eats up 25% of the Department of Justice budget. That takes money that could be used to run the courts, to track terrorists, to fund the FBI. All this money is going to incarceration. And again, if people were coming out better, it would be a good investment, but they're not. So we need to look at what do we need to change. If you went to a mechanic that after he fixed your car and you drove off the lot, 40% of the time it was still broken, you'd change mechanics. And in this case, 40% of the inmates are reoffending when they get out. We need to do something that changes that. That's how we'll drive down the crime rate. The states, as the founders of the Republic intended, have been on the cutting edge. Justice Brandeis famously said that the states are the laboratories of democracy, that each of the states can try different things and we see what works and then apply those lessons nationally. And frankly, the results of reforms in the states have been very impressive. It started in Texas, believe it or not, Tough on Crime Texas. And the Speaker of the House, Tom Craddock, said, we can't build any more prisons. We've got to do something to stop this. It's taking money from schools, roads, hospitals, and it's breaking the bank. So he called in Jerry Madden, a man who had no corrections experience, a West Point grad, an engineer, and said, Jerry, you've got to figure out how to keep the public safe without building any more prisons. And I love this work because I meet people from all sorts of backgrounds. I'm from a legal background, and I would never have thought of this. But Jerry, being an engineer, thought of it very directly. He said, well, we've got a system, and there are too many people in it. We can do one of two things. We can slow them down coming in, or we can speed them up going out. And the simplicity, that was beautiful. My father-in-law is an engineer, and that kind of logic is, really needed. And that really got down to, well, what do we do? What do we do to either slow people down or speed them up going out? And what do we do while we have them under our control that helps change their lives so that they stay on the straight and narrow? And that's obviously the object. We don't run prisons for prison's sake. We do it to help keep us safe. So let's hold them accountable for that. The record in Texas has been astounding. They not only have not built any more prisons, they already had three in the budget designed and ready to start. They took those out. Since then, they've closed eight existing prisons. And they've done it by taking low-level offenders and putting them in programs in the community. They've reserved the expensive prison beds for people that are truly dangerous and habitual criminals. For the others, they've punished in the community, but also gotten them into programs, drug and alcohol treatment, mental health services, job skills, matching them with jobs, matching them with mentors. All these things have worked so well that they have brought down the prison population. They've saved $3 billion, but even more important, they've cut the crime rate to the lowest it's been since 1967. So they've hit the magic spot. You know, they not only stop criminals from committing more crime, they have fewer victims, and they've saved billions of dollars. Who would not be for that? It just makes sense. And as again, we're trying to appeal to conservatives to say, wake up. This is a big government program that isn't working, that isn't giving us the results we want. We partner with both sides. We're nonpartisan, and Bob made a point of saying you're all nonpartisan. I have a terrific joy in working with people that normally I don't agree with. I think a lot of you probably know Maxine Waters. Well, she was the assistant majority leader when I was minority leader in the California Assembly, and we butted heads. Yet because of our work on this, on the steps of the Capitol, she came up and threw her arms around my neck and said, I love what you're doing, babe. Now, that is what the Bible told us. The lamb and the lion shall lie down together. You know, I say to her, we're going to check our guns at the door. You know, we beat our swords into plowshares. We find agreement on this. And you know the thing that's most in common that we have left and right? It's human dignity. That each human has worth. And the system tends to beat that down. As was mentioned in that article, while I was in prison, probably over 1,000 times, the guard said to me, snarled, you ain't got nothing coming. And implied in that is, you come from nothing, you are nothing, you will never be anything. When the guys leave the gate and they get their little bit of travel money and some clothes, often the guards say to them, see you in a few months. Think how discouraging that would be. You've served your time, you've paid your price to society, you want to get on with your life, and here the guard says, you're going to be back. That's where prison fellowship was such a joy to work for, because we said, no, you have hope. You know, you're a human being, you have dignity, you're created in the image and likeness of God, and you have a second chance in life. And we're here to help you. And that's the important thing of the community. Government can't love somebody. People can love somebody. Dr. King told us to change someone, you must first love them, and they must know that you love them. And that's what prison volunteers and mentors do. Bob told me his wife goes into prison and helps. That is such a statement of love to those prisoners. Oftentimes, there haven't been adults in their lives that have been very good to them. Some of these men and women have never had anybody say, I love you. That's hard to believe, but that's the reality. And just by her presence, Bob's wife is saying, I love you. You count. I care about you and your future. Think how uplifting that is. And then she says, I'll help give you skills that will help you on your path. That's the way out of this. And Texas has done that. Kansas has done it. Governor Brownback, now he's the ambassador of religious freedom, but he was governor of Kansas. He recruited, trained, and matched over 6,000 mentors for the Kansas inmates. Now think of that. It's one thing to go in and do a Bible study and pray with visitors. That's important. But it's a lot more to say, I'm here with you as your partner. I will work with you inside to help you develop a plan, but I will walk with you as you leave. And I'll help find you a safe place to live. I'll help you start a bank account, because most of them have never had a bank account. I'll help you get a driver's license. You know, I have trouble with dealing with the DMV. Think if you've been locked up for 15 years, the frustration dealing with the lines. To help them think through what should be on my resume. How do I be honest with an employer about my conviction, but also explain to them how I've changed and why I'm worth that risk? The mentors can do all that, and they don't cost the taxpayers a dime. Brownback showed it's possible. 6,000 mentors. That's more than all the other states in the union combined. But he showed it's possible. The result has been less crime, lower recidivism, fewer victims, and money saved to the taxpayers. That's the sweet spot. That's what we want. The problem we have is at the federal level, there's no limit to what they can spend. The states are constrained by balanced budgets. They have to have a balanced budget. That's a good discipline. In California, my opponents have found ways around that. They've been creative in their accounting and they're way in debt. But ostensibly, there's supposed to be a balanced budget. But most of the states do have balanced budgets. In Texas, it's a requirement of a balanced budget that made Tom Craddock, the speaker, call in Jerry Madden and say, we can't afford this because it's taking money. It's a zero-sum game. We can't have money for schools and hospitals and roads if we're increasing the money on prisons. And so that discipline forced them to look at alternatives and forced Republicans, not just for fiscal reasons, but then to question underneath, well, why do we lock people up? What is the benefit of it? And what's the cost to society, not just fiscally, but in human terms? What about the families that are torn apart? What about the unemployment because they're unemployable now from conviction? And it forced them to think through all those things and come up with some very creative things that result in savings but also lower crime rates. The federal government doesn't have that fiscal discipline, so it's been tougher to get their attention. But we have done that, and we're reaching critical mass. I think this year we're going to see substantial reforms pass. The president has said an initiative that he's sponsoring to deal with this, and it surprised a lot of people. But frankly, I've been working with the administration, and let me tell a little side story. This is how God works. I met Jared Kushner 10 years ago, long before anybody ever thought of his father. He didn't even have a father-in-law then. His dad had gone to prison, and I was called by Gary Bauer and asked, would I meet with Mrs. Kushner and her sons, because she was very much afraid, they're Orthodox Jews, and they were afraid he wouldn't be able to keep kosher and that he would face discrimination. And Gary knew I'd been very active in protecting religious freedom for prisoners. And so I met with them, and I explained to them that he was entitled to kosher meals, and if he was denied them, because I saw it, I saw them deny meals to Isaac Jakubovich, a wonderful Orthodox Jew that I served time with. So I knew it happened, but I said, I'll stand with you. I'll go to fight if they do. But it turned out Mr. Kushner was able to keep kosher. They had enough Jews there that they could have a minyan, which they were worried about. I also talked about practical things, how to get people on his list for visitors, how to get people's phone numbers so they could be on his phone call, how to get, you're allowed one box a year, so how to get things into him, especially, you know, matzah and appropriate foods for Passover and the other holidays. And then I said, could I pray with you? And they said, certainly. And I prayed very earnestly, and when I finished, they came up, and especially Mrs. Kushner was just so dear, but obviously so distraught. She grasped my hand and said, thank you so much. This is a blessing. And so they went and got in their plane and flew home, and I didn't think anything about it. And then in July of 2016, I turn on my computer, and it says Donald Trump's son-in-law is going to be helping in his campaign. And I call it, Gail, Gail, remember the people I met with? That's Trump's son-in-law. So I wrote him an email and said, I don't know if you remember me, but I met with your dear mother and your brothers and you, and I'm involved in trying to reform the criminal justice system. I'd love to work with you in trying to make that part of the president's initiatives. And he wrote back immediately and said, oh, Pat, of course I remember you. You gave me hope when there was none. And I'd love to work with you. And so You know, the way God works, I say he wastes nothing. 10 years before, when both of us would have laughed if we said that he would marry Donald Trump's daughter and that Donald Trump would become president, and yet here he's been put in the position to be able to affect this, to get the president's attention and say this is an important subject. And I think I'm a pretty good sailor of the political craft, but Jared is one smart son of a gun. He is very, very quick learner and very savvy, and he's put together a proposal. It won't do everything we want, but I've learned, Chuck would always tell me, don't let the perfect be the enemy of the good. And this does three very important things, the initiative. First, it says we're going to have job training and match them with jobs for jobs that actually exist. Unfortunately, in a federal system, they have a smattering of job programs, but they aren't jobs in the real world. An example is one of the facilities, they take furniture made somewhere else, they shrink wrap it and ship it because furniture from the prisons gets first call on government contracts. Well, shrink-wrapping furniture is not a job that's a lot of people seeking people with that training. If they were making furniture, it would be one thing, but just shrink-wrapping it obviously is not a skill they need. So it's to set up real, to work with businesses to set up real opportunities, pay the inmates real wages so they can send money to their family, they can pay restitution to their victims, they can set aside money for gate money, learn those skills, and to match them with employers willing to hire them when they get out. Because one of the things that's so frustrating is so many inmates get out, they go to job fairs, and they're just turned down routinely, automatically, convicted, out of here, round file, not even looked at. So the first is job training and matching. The second is mentoring, coming alongside them, people from the community that say, I'm with you, I'm helping you. And that's so uplifting to inmates that somebody thinks and cares enough about them that they'll get involved in the messy details of their life. The fascinating thing is where this is done, the probation officers love it. First, they're a little suspicious. You know, what is this, a hug-a-thug program? But what they find is the mentors are far more involved in the inmate's life than they could ever be. And so if the inmate stumbles and gets in trouble, the probation officer will say, is this guy making it? What do you think? And one of the things that we train mentors to do is be honest. If they're not making it, say, you know, he's struggling, but I don't think he'll make it. On the other hand, if he's really making an effort, if he's really doing well, he's hitting on all the scores and just happens to stumble, let's cut him some slack. Let's let him stay, you know, keep his job, stay with his family. And the probation officers love it. It's like having an auxiliary staff to help them at no cost to the government. So the second thing is mentoring. And then the third thing is drug and alcohol treatment and mental health services. Over 50% of federal prisoners are in for drug-related crimes. Over 50%. Less of those, less than 10% receive any addiction treatment. Less than 10%. So they're locked up for these long mandatory sentences, locked up for 5, 10, 15 years, but nothing is done about the underlying addiction. When they're released, they're still an addict. Now that's a danger to us. You know, why on earth, literally, we have a captive audience, why wouldn't we be helping them with their addiction so they come out clean and sober and ready to stay on the straight and narrow? The government hasn't funded those programs, so the idea is that we will. And the support for this in the House, Doug Collins from Georgia and Hakeem Jeffries from New Jersey, left and right, Democrat and Republican, have joined together. It's supported by Bob Goodlatte, the chairman of the Judiciary Committee. It's supported by the Speaker, Paul Ryan, his entire leadership team. In the Senate, the legislation isn't for certain agreed to, but Grassley, Senator Grassley and Durbin and Senators Lee and Paul are committed to reforms, and the important thing is Mitch McConnell has agreed to give it floor time. And the rules of the Senate are such floor time is the most valuable thing in the world. And if there's going to be a squabble or a spat, McConnell doesn't want to do it because it eats up time that could be on other things. He's agreed to give it that floor time, and that is worth all the money in the world. And again, I'm so impressed that Jared's been able to line all this stuff up. So what we're doing is trying to build public support for it. And again, liberals traditionally support these programs. Conservatives haven't. They've been defensive of our system. But we found more and more, like some of the leaders you saw on that tape, more and more are saying, hey, there's a better way to do things. And we not only have Newt, Ken Cuccinelli, Grover, Norquist, but David Keene, former president of the NRA, Ed Meese, Reagan's attorney general, three other state attorneys, Republican state attorneys general, people with real credibility among conservatives that have stepped forward and said, this is the right thing to do. Let's join hands left and right to do this. But this is where you come in. It's so important that you be involved. First, educate yourself on this. Be able to discuss it with your neighbors, with professional groups, with service clubs that you're in, with your church or synagogue, with people there. Be able to discuss it. Educate yourself. There was a task force set up by Congress named after Chuck Colson, called the Chuck Colson Task Force. Its report on the federal prison system and how it needs to be changed is breathtaking. It is so thoroughly researched, and the ideas are so good. It is a gem, and I'd really recommend you all read it. It's very readable. It had top corrections, law enforcement, church leaders on it. It was a bipartisan group, and the report is phenomenal. So that'll be a good resource. Go to our website. We've got these cards that lists our website to you, our Facebook page, our Twitter. We'll keep you informed as legislation comes up. Because the second thing after being informed is you need to let your legislators know where you are. Everett Dirksen, the great senator from Illinois, used to say, when I feel the heat, I see the light. And that's the way legislators think. They need to hear from you. They need to hear what's on your mind, that you're an average citizen and you care about this. Because the myth is nobody cares. The prisoners are forgotten. No one cares what happens to them. Well, I got a bulletin for them. 95% of prisoners are going to be released. We can't afford to lock them up forever. So they're going to be our neighbors. What kind of neighbors are they going to be? Are they prepared to be good husbands, good parents, good employees, good members of the community, involved in community functions? Many prisoners have been. We want to make sure more are. And you can deliver that message to legislators. The second thing is communicate with them that you're a voter and you'll be watching. You'll be following their votes. And if they vote for these reforms, if they vote in accord with what you say, write a letter to the editor praising them. Too many times, you know, people ask a legislator, and when they vote right, they let it go. It's important to say thank you. We all love that. But it also informs other people that this legislator is doing what the people want. If they don't, write a nice letter, not vituperative, but saying, I'm disappointed that they didn't. Here are the reasons why we need these reforms. I'm disappointed that our legislator didn't do that. And that's, what is different about this country is that we have the ability to affect legislation, to affect who represents us. I mean, that was a revolutionary concept when our country was founded, and it still sets us apart from most others. We have the ability to affect that. But it's up to us to exercise that. The last thing I'll say is, before we have Q&A, a friend of mine said, well, What would America look like if we put into practice these policies of yours? And I thought about it, you know, well, what's our vision? And I'd grown up in central L.A. on Crenshaw Boulevard, and it was a rough neighborhood, and everybody in my family was a victim of crime, some very violent. All of our neighbors were victims. And I'd been a reserve deputy sheriff for 20 years, riding as a second man in the sheriff cars in the second toughest substation in L.A. County. And so I thought, well, I want a neighborhood where kids could go to the store to get a loaf of bread for their parents, or a grandmother can walk out and pick up the paper and not fear being accosted, where kids go to school and feel safe. The next day in my Bible reading, it turned out we were in Isaiah, and it was 32:18, Isaiah 32:18. And I realized God had already written the vision statement before me. He said, "My people will live in peaceful communities, in secure homes, and in tranquil places of rest." That's shalom. That's the right order thing that God wants. Think of that. Working together, we can help create a community that's safe, secure, and tranquil. And future generations will thank us for helping turn this system around so that we have those communities of shalom. Thanks for the chance to share these ideas with you. Is there time for Q&A? No,
okay. I'm going to call on people because
okay,
they need
great.
Some mic.
Yep.
It's
yep.
So per usual, if you want to ask questions, just raise your hand. You need to have a microphone. Oh, and I'm being told I need a microphone.
Yeah.
You all need to have a microphone. Please raise your hand, and either John or Madison will come to you.
Referenced a report that you encouraged us to read. What was the name of the report again?
Yes. The Chuck Colson Task Force. And if you just Google that, the Urban Institute has the report preserved so everybody can continue to have access to it. And it's very good. I'm sorry, I forgot to mention Virginia legislation. And frankly, that's really important to all of us. The session is now over, other than the budget special session. A couple of bills were passed that are very good. One raises the threshold for theft from, pardon me? Right. Raises it from $300 to $500. You think about it, a kid steals an iPhone, that's $800. That automatically makes them a felon. They shouldn't be stealing the phone, but it's, you know, it's kind of hard to say that person's a felon. It'll be branded with that F the rest of their life and have to report on every job application and everything. I'm sorry, I'm drawing a blank. There was a bill that, sorry, I have to, oh, it's in my briefcase. I really apologize. Memory is a terrible thing to lose. Mine's like Swiss cheese.
Oh,
yeah, it'll come. But especially in the budget, they've closed a juvenile facility, which is really good. You know, kids are taken away from their parents for things as simple as frequent truancy, encourageability, talking back to their parents. Now, those are not good things. I raised three teenagers with my wife. I know those aren't good things. But it's also a sin to take those children out of their home and put them in a facility where they're liable to be beaten and sexually assaulted. And certainly they're not going to come out better than they went in. So they've closed that, but unfortunately there's a proposal to build two more juvenile facilities, these very large facilities, far from where most of the families live, so it isolates the children from their families. I hope you'd contact your legislators and say, let's put this off to next year and let's study if there are alternative ways to deal with these status offenses, kids that stay out all night and that talk back to their parents and that are truant. Maybe there's something short of incarceration, putting them in a facility that we can do. And in fact, other states have done that, and quite successfully. So that's something you can do while they're in special session now. Say, don't run or jump into this so fast to build those two new facilities. Let's hold off and see if that money can be better spent really helping these kids with the challenges they face and are dealing with, not just take them away from their families. We all know, and there's some abusive families, but unless there's evidence of abuse, the family is always the people that care the most about these children. And, you know, they, when possible, we need to keep families together.
I'm thinking about the distinction between state and federal. I presume with federal there's more rules and so forth. And you mentioned a couple of states that are doing right. But my question really has to do with for-profit prisons. Mm-hmm. Seems to me they're a bane on justice system. And I don't know what percentage are for profit or how we can get rid of them.
Mm-hmm. Well, I have a different opinion on it. I don't care who signs the check. There's abuse in government prisons as well as private. There are people, officials, that feed the inmates poorly in government prisons as well as private. In Louisiana, it was just exposed that a sheriff took money that was supposed to go food for the jailed inmates and instead spent $700,000 on himself and his wife. That could have fed those people. So I found Alexander Solzhenitsyn said, the line between good and evil runs not between nations and not between people, but through the center of every human heart. It's a human condition that there is bad in the world, and we're called to be our better angels. And frankly, private or public, we need to hold them accountable for decent circumstances, for good medical care, for doing all they can to keep the families together and to prepare the men and women to be released. Some privates do a terrible job. Others do a very good job, and the inmates will tell you that. So it's accountability. And frankly, a lot of corrections people privately will say there's more accountability in the privates because they have contracts they have to fulfill and benchmarks they have to meet. Government-run prisons don't have that. And, frankly, the scandals are, you know, the lady you saw in there that was raped by a guard was in a federal prison. It was a government prison. And, incidents of rape, it's estimated at a minimum that 5% of inmates are sexually assaulted. Of juveniles, it's 10%. Over half of those are by guards, by government employees. So, you know, we need accountability no matter where they're from, and that's what we need to do. Justice Brandeis is a very wise man. We need the... He said sunshine is the best disinfectant and the street lamp the best cop. We need to shine the light on these institutions, public or private, and say, how are they treating the people? Remember I said the basic thing we have in common, left and right, is human dignity. Is that human dignity being expressed, protected, and encouraged? And if not, we need to hold them accountable for it.
Two items that I didn't hear you address exactly. One of them is I understand that there's a major issue with mandatory sentencing guidelines. So I thought you might address that. And then secondly, I think it's related, but our Attorney General has just encouraged prosecutors to exercise the toughest decisions they can make. Is that, am I missing something?
I wish you were. Tell me it ain't so, Jeff. First, as far as mandatory minimum sentences, they're totally unjust. It bears no relation to the crime committed other than what's charged by the prosecutor. One of the things I'd like to see change over the years is we not refer to crime as breaking laws, but instead harming victims. It's important we see the harm done to someone. That's what a crime is. When Cain killed Abel, it broke God's heart. That was the sin. He broke the right order of things. He shouldn't have harmed his brother. It wasn't a law. There was no statute against murder then, but it was wrong. And we need to focus on the victim, how the victim was harmed, and hold the offender accountable for that. Instead, under mandatory minimums, it's like a light switch. It's either on or it's off. You're guilty or you're not. It doesn't take into account the role you played in that crime. Our conspiracy laws allow them to attribute every part of a drug ring to the smallest member of them. And what we end up with is what they call the girlfriend prosecution. You know, they say, you know, we have to have these tough sentences because people rat up the chain and get Mr. Big. It doesn't work that way. They rat down the chain. If you rat up the chain, you die. You know, they kill and kidnap people that rat up the chain. But people down the chain that aren't as dangerous, that's who people rat out. Well, when it gets down to the girlfriend who took two phone messages for his boyfriend, she's got nobody to rat out. And her boyfriend says, oh, yeah, she knew everything that was being done. He's willing to testify. Huge amounts of cocaine that she used and distributed. Why? Because that gets him a lesser sentence. It's totally unjust. Instead, we ought to look at the role people play in the crime, and the punishment should be in accord to the role they did and the harm they did, not just that they were, you know, yes or no, the prosecutor, because it puts all the leverage in the prosecutor's hand. That's why 95% of cases are plea bargained out, because the penalties are so high, nobody dares assert their innocence. So I'm totally against mandatory minimums. They're not in these federal sentences, and I'll be blunt with you, there's too much opposition to it. And, you know, we've tried for years to change it. We've tinkered some, adjusted some, but it's been enough to stop the last several attempts at criminal justice reform. So we've made the decision, let's limit ourselves to prison reform, the three areas we've said, but the rest of us are going to continue to work. You know, the old joke about how do you eat an elephant one bite at a time? You know, let's get this done and passed. And frankly, part of it is to show Republicans you can vote for something like this and it doesn't endanger your career. Now, in Texas, they've seen that. Nobody's lost an election because they supported these reforms. But the federal legislators aren't. And there's a generational problem. Most of the federal legislators got elected in the 60s when it was much more partisan, tough-on-crime rhetoric. So they're sort of steeped in that, and we have to wean them off of that. So that's why we don't address mandatory minimums. But they are evil. It's not justice. But now yet a second question. I apologize. Oh, that's very distressing. Of course, they have the authority to charge anything they want. But it's the duty of prosecutors. They not only, and Ken Cuccinelli said this, you know, they're not hired guns. They're representatives of the people supposed to do justice. A lot of people don't realize it, but Ken Cuccinelli is attorney general, stepped down as attorney general temporarily to defend and push for the release of four people that have been wrongly convicted and were caught in the system, the Supreme Court not hearing their case, and they were languishing in prison. unfairly. And he said, this is ridiculous that, you know, we would do this. He also was the only Republican to vote against the death penalty for the so-called wheelman. You know, again, the conspiracies, all of it is attributed. So if there's a kid with his friends and they go to the liquor store and his friends go in and steal some beer and the clerk pulls a gun and they wrestle over it and the clerk gets shot, the kid in the car that had nothing to do with that can be charged with murder and the death sentence. Ken voted against that. He said that's unconscionable. You know, he shouldn't be held accountable for what other people did. Hold him accountable for what he did, but not that. So there's a growing move among conservatives to say, we need to be more discerning. But Attorney General Sessions has instead said, go for the max. And that's not justice. That's winning. And it's not about winning. It's about doing justice.
Pat, let me jump in following that last question. So you mentioned the House bill, the Collins bill, which is about prison reform.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the Grassley-Durbin thing in the Senate is about prison reform, but also sentencing reform.
Right.
And that's been much in the news, and Grassley's trying to pull in his chips with the president and so forth. Is there a snowball's chance in whatever that can pass?
No. I wish it were. But that's what's held it up, is the sentencing part. And there's enough Republican opposition that there would be a fight on the floor. It would eat up time. And McConnell has said it's not going to come up if there's that kind of division on it. And, you know, sometimes you just have to accept the way things are. You know, go for what you can and then go for more after that. Again, the Grassley-Durbin bill is good. It's not perfect, frankly. I don't think it goes far enough on mandatory minimums because it still leaves the structure in place, which gives all the leverage to the prosecutor. But it's not going to pass, and I am looking, and I think most of us are looking for something that can pass. And again, tens of thousands of people will be benefited by the prison reform. More would be benefited by the sentencing reform, but we shouldn't leave on the table those we can help with the more modest bill.
Just for people that haven't been following it, you said this, but both of these bills, these things tend to have huge numbers of co-sponsors, Democrat and Republican, so there is a lot of support for them.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. The Senate is I don't want to say an odd creature. I was in the lower house in the assembly, and we used to refer to our Senate as the Cave of Winds. we also say there's something in the drinking fountains in Senate. It's true across the country in the U.S. Senate. People that were great members of the lower house suddenly become elite and distant. You know, it's really funny to see, but it happens. There is a lot of support. It's just because of McConnell and the rules of the Senate, the filibuster, they don't really have filibusters anymore. All you have to do is threaten a filibuster and things get pulled from the file. I've said call their bluff. Bring in the cots. And unfortunately, even people that support legislation, they tend to be our age, the senators, and they don't want to spend the night on the cot. Seriously, they've said, I don't want to do it. And I said, well, isn't that part of the job? You know. And I've also learned, some folks don't realize it, that your opponent needs to think you're crazy enough to do it. That's how you have leverage. And so what we ought to do is call the bluff for the opponents that are only a tiny number, and say, okay, we'll stay here. One of the rules is that with a filibuster, people can speak, senators can speak, they can speak twice. Then there's no cloture rule. Debate ends then. People don't realize that. So if they sit there and let every senator speak twice that wants to, at the end of that time, if nobody else wants to speak or they've used their two times, you go to a vote, And I say, do it. You know, and you do that one or two times, and people will pay more attention, in my opinion. Now, what I forgot about Virginia, and I don't want to keep you over time, is there's a bill about driver's licenses. And this is a move we're doing in several states. Unfortunately, it didn't pass here. We're going to go back next year. But one of the absurd thing is, you know, today on crimes, the actual fine for the crime isn't as much. All the fees and taxes, you know, it can be hundreds of dollars for a traffic offense. And a lot of people lose their license because they don't realize they've run up this bill. And, you know, if you're a poor person and your license is suspended, it's just a downward spiral. You know, how do you pay that fine? How do you pay anything else that might come up? You know, it's just counterproductive to say you can't drive. And to somebody that's just been released from prison to say, oh, you had these back fines, how are they going to get to work? Public transportation doesn't go to most jobs, doesn't go to most probation officers. How on earth can they function? So it basically pushes them back into the system. So we're saying don't automatically remove it. If the offense involves a driving offense that's serious enough, yes. But it should be a determination like that, not just automatic suspension. I don't know why it didn't pass. To me, it makes eminent sense. Texas has passed it. You know, as Grover Norquist says, you know, if Vermont did these reforms, nobody pay attention. But Texas doing it, that's something. So Virginia ought to follow that. And we're going to continue to push for that.
I just wondered what your opinion was on the concept of restorative justice.
Oh. Yeah.
Rather than the traditional punishment model.
Yeah, well, you've hit the sweet spot for me. That restorative justice is absolutely the way to go. And again, it's victim-centered. You know, you look at the actual harm that's done. But the purpose of it is to try to find reconciliation. You allow, and this is, again, only if the victim wants it. Yeah, it should all be at the choice of the victim. And many victims want it, and they're discouraged from doing it, if you can believe it. But they meet after preparation, and they each get to tell their story. The victim gets to tell how the crime affected them, not just the actual crime, but the residual effects, inability to sleep at night, inability to have relations with their husband, the loss of a job, anxiety, medical treatments. Most offenders don't think of the harm. All they think is, you know, they're going to grab that purse or whatever. This forces them to actually hear the harm they've done. But then they tell their circumstances. The offender then tells their circumstances. And it humanizes the offender to the victim. And what happens in the process, not always, but oftentimes, all of a sudden they understand more. You know, this is a kid whose parents beat him and abused him. He ran away from home at 13. He lived on the street, got involved in drugs, sleeping under a bridge, you know, turned to crime to support his habit because he's now addicted. That doesn't excuse what he did, but it explains a little more about it. And makes the victim more amenable to trying to work something out. And the intent of restorative justice is to reach an agreement where the offender, first of all, what victims want more than anything, they don't want prison sentences as much. They want all the lying and BS to stop. They want the offender to acknowledge, yes, I did it, and to apologize. That's worth its weight in gold to a victim. At that point, most victims become very forward-looking, and they say, how can we make sure you don't do this again? Oftentimes, the restorative contract will involve staying in school. It may involve community service. You know, there's nothing like helping at a soup kitchen or doing chores at a senior center that helps offenders see that they can live a contributing productive life. It's not all about them. And that's one of the problems we have today. So many kids think it's all about them. I'm not here to proselytize anybody, but one of the fascinating things, just the very acceptance of the existence of God changes inmates' attitude, because it says there's something more important than me. There's something that expects more of me. And no matter what the faith, that's a common tenet, and you see that change. Otherwise, why shouldn't you grab the old lady's handbag? Why shouldn't you shoot up with drugs? It helps you put the pain out of your mind. You know, a whole range of things. If it's all about you, why not do it? And the problem is society unravels with that. So restorative justice, you know, right not far from here is Eastern Mennonite University, which the Mennonites are the pioneers in the field of restorative justice. You've got a working laboratory. If Virginia would adopt even just a parallel system of restorative justice, offering that option would be wonderful. We had to fight. I was at a hearing on criminal justice reform, and the wife of a deputy had been home and was raped by somebody that she identified. He was in prison. She asked to meet with him. The Department of Corrections refused to allow her to do that. Now, why on earth would they do that? They said it wasn't in her interest to do that. Well, who died made them God. You know, she's an adult. You know, she's in control of her senses. Now, you may want to prepare, and most programs do, but to say no? So Rob Bell heard that, and he introduced a bill to say if a victim asks for it, they're allowed to do it. God bless him for doing that. Rob's not always aboard on reforms, but on that, he jumped on it and was good. Again, we should be victim-centered, but what we found is victims are much more willing to accept non-traditional punishments if the offender has said, look, I did it, and I'm sorry. That means a lot. Now, the interesting thing is defense attorneys hate restorative justice. You know, they want to maintain, I never did it, no how, you know, I wasn't there, but if I was, I didn't do it, you know. So anyway, does that give you a sufficient answer?
I've heard many stories about the debt that an inmate incurs while he's in prison, mm-hmm. and how difficult it is to overcome that. Mm-hmm. How does that happen? Mm-hmm. And does the family become a victim if they try to support that inmate while he's there?
Wow, that is a huge problem. Oftentimes it stems from child support. The bill continues to roll even though they're in a position where they may be earning 12 cents an hour or 17 cents an hour, but it's just added onto the tab, so they may leave prison not only owing whatever fine and fee from the crime, but then all this back child support, and it can be over $100,000. And it's like Sisyphus pushing the rock up the hill. They're never going to make it. You know, this debt just hangs over them. And depending on the probation officer they have, if they get an enlightened one, they're understanding. But if they get one that wants to make their life miserable, they hound them. You know, you owe this debt. And literally, I've had friends where they said, you don't need cable TV. You don't need the internet. You don't need a newspaper. You don't need a cell phone. Seriously, they go through all their expenses and tell them all this. And when the family sends money in to the inmate so that they can have postage stamps to write home, so they can have money on the books to make phone calls, so they may buy a chunky monkey every few weeks to, you know, supplement their prison diet. A lot of systems sweep that money out, and it goes into this back debt. And so the families can't get money to their loved one because it's all diverted into these funds. Let me tell you also a game that goes on. I'm all for victim restitution. It's important for a victim to know that the person that harmed them through the sweat of their brow is helping make up for it. Now, maybe they can never earn enough to do that, but there needs to be some gesture like that. Unfortunately, most restitution programs are restitution in name only. Instead, it's a fixed amount that applies to every crime, no matter what harm is done, no matter what the involvement of the person was. It's a fixed amount, and it doesn't go to that individual victim. It goes into a central fund. And what's done with the fund? They have a schedule where it's doled out to victims, again, not in relation to the harm that's done them, and a great photo op for a government official as they hand them the check. And that's not satisfying to the victim because it hasn't come from the person that harmed them. And all it is a PR stunt. Oh, look at me, I'm helping the victims. And the victims are glad to get it, but it's not restitution. It's not the offender helping make things right. And that's what restitution is. So don't be sucked into the con game. Well, we got to have restitution. Ask, what are the details of restitution? I supported it in California, and then the Attorney General set up this system of PR photos for him giving checks. And I said, but that's not restitution. Unfortunately, the proposition I'd supported said the Attorney General will establish the structure to carry this out. So he set up a PR structure. it's terrible to have an inmate face unpayable debts when they get out. Yes, there should be some token, maybe even a substantial token, to the people they've harmed. And going forward, they should pay child support. But you can't get blood from a turnip. Why on earth penalize the inmate because they don't have income?
How about their charges while they are incarcerated for things like Tylenol or Band-Aid or something like that? I've heard that that is considerable expense because they're overcharged for those items.
Yeah, it depends on the prison system, but that is a scam. I've said the prison system is a whale, and there are all these pilot fish around it that live off the whale. And all these companies, you know, you go to an American Correctional Association convention, and you've got a huge hall of exhibits of people that sell things to or for the prison system. Handcuffs, bunks, safety vests, food, you know, you name it. Literally thousands of vendors who live off the prison system and have a vested interest in it. That's something that, frankly, the legislature ought to look on, especially things like medical products. I don't want to get in an insensitive area, but the way women are treated is especially bad. Some systems limit women to 12 sanitary pads a month and no tampons. If they want a tampon, they have to pay for them themselves. Now, that's just wrong. Also, they give them one roll of toilet paper per month. This, you know, that's just plain cruel and vindictive, just like shackling women during pregnancy. Why on earth would you do that? You've got an armed guard there. Do they think the woman's going to get up off the gurney and run? There's never been a pregnant woman escape, and yet many systems, Virginia prohibits it in the state system, but the county jails all do it. Now, that's just barbaric. You know, there's no social purpose to it. It's just vindictiveness. It's cruel. And there's this, it's justified on the basis, well, we have to treat all the inmates the same, men as well as women. Well, no, they're different. You know, there are certain things that are different. Men can't get pregnant. Men can fake illness, and they can escape when they go to the hospital. I defy any woman to be able to fake pregnancy or to abscond while they're on the gurney, you know. But this, I tell people, prisons are, you take a DMV office and string barbed wire on it and give the guards guns. That's the attitude of it. Totally apart from reality. And again, you know, it's funny, but it's sad. You know, I had to deal with this 20 months, some guys and women 10 or 15 years. And it's up to us to say, no, that's wrong. We treat these people with dignity. We expect you to treat them with dignity. You know, if you treat, if you're like a barbarian to them inside, what kind of neighbor are they going to be when they get out? You know, it's in our interest that they be treated well. It's also the moral thing to do. But, you know, why on earth would you humiliate a woman and put her in pain during childbirth? And also, I might say, it's not just during childbirth. When they go to court, they're all strung together. And I had it too. You have manacles on, or shackles on your feet. There's a chain that comes up to a belly chain on your waist. Your wrists are then connected to the belly chain. It's almost impossible to get in and out of the van if you're a pregnant woman. You know, and oftentimes the guards won't help them. But you're in a daisy chain. And if somebody in front of you trips and falls, they all fall like 10 pins. Now, a woman that's pregnant can't move her hands to protect her child. When my mom was pregnant with my younger brother, God bless her, she was painting windows and misjudged where the top of the ladder was and fell down and broke both her wrists trying to protect Tom. And she gave birth with her wrists in casts. If she'd been manacled, she couldn't have protected him. You know, why would we do this to these women? You know, so anyway, we need to sensitize people to it. And now, there are corrections officials that justify it, but nobody else. You'd have to be an awfully hardened bureaucrat to say, well, that's the way it ought to be. So that's something we ought to try to change here. But the sheriffs fight it. Anyway, thank you for this chance.
Pat, thank you for educating us, teaching us a lot, and for being here. As I said at the beginning, if any of you, this is such an important problem, if any of you feel like getting together to study the various bills and things that are going on in the state of Virginia, also at the federal level, and presenting some things to the group as a whole for advocacy, please let me know afterward or let somebody back at the desk know. So thanks, Pat, very much.
Thank you so much.